In our cities, we stand in silent buses and subway cars, barely acknowledging one another, even as rates of loneliness skyrocket. Online, we retreat into ideological silos reinforced by algorithms designed to serve us only familiar ideas and like-minded users. In our politics, we're increasingly consumed by a fear of people that we've never met. In his new book, The Power of Strangers, with the help of sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists, theologians, philosophers, and political scientists, Joe Cohane sets out on a journey to discover what happens when we bridge the distance between us and people we don't know. The name of the book is The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. It is published by Random House, and we welcome journalist Joe Cohane to the roundtable this morning. Joe, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So what brought you to this particular subject of our interaction with strangers?
Yeah, it's funny. It was a few years ago I realized that I had just stopped talking to strangers. I was raised by fairly extroverted parents who talk to strangers all the time. And as a result, I got to see the sort of benefits that they reaped from doing it. But a few years ago, and I always did it myself, you know, to a lesser degree, but I still did it, and I enjoyed it. But I just found that I had just eliminated this entire category of social interaction from my life, and I kind of wondered why. And for me personally, I think it was a mix of two things. It was the fact that I had a very demanding job and a small child, so I was tired and distracted, and I just wasn't out in public that much. But also that I had a phone, so on the rare chance that I would go to a bar or a coffee shop, I would just be staring at my phone like a dope instead of like acknowledging the people around me. So, the more I thought about that, the more I thought about what I was missing. And then I started thinking bigger, like why don't people in general talk to strangers and what happens when they do?
So when it comes to our suspicions, when it comes to us being a little uneasy, where does that come from?
That is a whole insidious cocktail of factors that derives our awareness of strangers. So the first thing you got to think about is that part of it is innate, right? Like we are innately a little wary of strangers. That's just the way humans are. When we feel threatened, when we feel insecure, we're going to be a little wary of new people. And that's just because we don't know what they're up to. We don't know what they're thinking. We don't know what their motivations are. So that's always there, you know. And when we make people feel more comfortable, they tend to be a lot more open to strangers. But there's a lot of other factors, too. I mean, obviously, like racial and class and gender divides can exacerbate it. They can make people anxious about interacting with other people. And for me and for a lot of people of my generation, the relentless stranger danger propaganda that we were fed in school also right. may have poisoned us against everyone in the world that we hadn't met. and political science research is now finding that that might have actually eroded the capacity of a whole generation to trust other people. So those are just a couple things. There are a lot more factors, too, but it's definitely there's a lot of anxiety attached to these sorts of interactions with people.
So part of what you try to do in this book is to look at what happens when we bridge that distance between us and the people that we don't know. So how do we first create the bridges?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing you have to do, you know, in many cases, is just teach yourself how to do this again, to go back out there and start talking to people again. And that's a big ask. I mean, even before COVID, people were very anxious about talking to strangers for a lot of reasons, obviously. And now after COVID, like we've been out of circulation for quite some time, so we're doubly anxious about doing it. The good news is that there's a great deal of research out there now that shows that though we're very worried about these conversations and we fear that we're going to be bad at them and we fear that we're not going to have anything to say and we fear rejection, that by and large, they go much better than people expect. Again and again and again, we've seen in the research that we expect to be rejected. If we're not rejected, we expect the conversation to be sort of stilted and short. And those predictions don't bear out. People's pessimism generally is not borne out. Usually these conversations will go longer than they expected. They'll enjoy them more than they expected. The other people will like them more than they expected. It'll make their day better. And some of the research, or a lot of the research, has found that it makes people happier. It makes them feel more connected, more trusting, maybe more optimistic. It enhances their sense of belonging. It can alleviate loneliness. It can alleviate prejudice. All these things can happen as a result of like a meaningful conversation with a stranger, even if it's a relatively brief one. You just have to go do it.
When you think of what the situation that presents itself is, that would put you in close proximity to a stranger, and why, I guess, ultimately, what are you trying to get out of it, right? I mean, should you figure out what whether this is a nanosecond in your a blip in your brain as to, okay, I'm going to interact with this person, what am I trying to accomplish?
It's sort of a violation of the thing to think of it as just in brutally like practical terms. But, you know, in addition to some of the benefits that psychologists have found about how it can make us feel happier and it can help us belong, what's truly valuable about it to me is the opportunity to see the world through the eyes of another person, right?
Right.
And when you do that enough, when you talk to enough people who are different than you are, it makes it very difficult to nurture the idea that your reality is everybody's reality. You're awakened to the way that everybody's reality is a little different. People's experiences are a little different. And when you interact with that, when you have an opportunity to take some of those experiences in and take in some of those insights, for me, that's just the road to wisdom. I think that could really deepen you as a person. And I think it's hugely beneficial on an individual level, but also for society.
You talked a moment ago about stranger danger and how that has gone into our brains, and we, many of us have been taught that as children. But we also have heard this notion of the kindness of strangers, and that's the polar opposite of that. So that is important. I mean, that came to be for a reason as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do tend to be sort of pessimistic about human nature and about, you know, whether people are good or bad. The answer is that we're variable, right? Like, we can be really exclusionary in some contexts, and we can be violent, we can dehumanize each other, but we can be remarkably cooperative and empathetic and altruistic with strangers, given the right context. What's really critical to understand and appreciate is the fact that the reason society and civilization exist is because we have this really remarkable capacity to communicate with strangers and to cooperate with strangers. You know, if like our default mode was to hate strangers and kill strangers and demonize strangers and dehumanize strangers, civilization would have been impossible. You know, there's a reason that some evolutionary biologists refer to us as like an extraordinary evolutionary abnormality, a sort of ape that can cooperate with strangers and even sacrifice for strangers. This is not our default mode all the time, but I would argue that it's our default mode most of the time. And that should be appreciated. That should give us better data and maybe a fuller understanding of what our nature is and what we're capable of.
It seems, and I was thinking about this as I was reading the book, I mean, and you hit on it a couple of times. As we read this book now, it's impossible to read this and not think about the polarization that we have politically, and that whether it be talking about who you're going to vote for or whether or not to get the vaccine or whether to wear masks, that those conversations are more fraught now than ever. Does this particular time that we're in, the cycle that we're in, have an impact on how we communicate with people we don't know?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great point. In times of really extreme political polarization, one of the consequences is dehumanization. Right. We withdraw from one another. We fail to exercise any curiosity about one another. We simplify one another. We demonize one another. And at a certain point, that becomes so comprehensive that you just see no reason to ever interact with one another. And it becomes sort of a downward spiral. I think we're definitely in that mode right now of this sort of like serial dehumanization on both sides. It makes it really hard for people to talk to strangers because we think so little of each other. You know, if I would look across the aisle and say, like, that's sort of a witless cog in a machine, there's no benefit to me talking to them. And my side keeps reinforcing that message that we should not talk to that other side. But I don't think there's any way out of our current predicament without people exercising some curiosity about each other and wondering about each other and trying to talk to each other in a constructive way.
You have a chapter in the book entitled How to Talk to Enemy Strangers. Give us a sense of what makes a stranger an enemy stranger and what we gain from embarking in a conversation with them.
Yeah, so an enemy stranger is obviously someone who's most likely a representative of another group that's not your group, that your group is at odds with, right? And when you have two groups fighting together like that or in conflict with one another, like I said, they tend to dehumanize each other. And then that just kind of starts the spiral. the benefits of talking to those people is that it makes it virtually impossible for us to maintain a really simplified idea of who the other side is, right? So this is like one of the first bodies off the back of the truck in times of really intense polarization, is this belief that the other side is simple, right? Their motivations are simple and predictable. They are like at best one lunged organisms, while the people on our side are like full human beings, you know, capable of agency and free will and all kinds of other stuff. This is the problem. And this is like when you start to see each other as less than human. The research shows that, and I've seen this play out in real life too. I've attended conventions that try to teach Republicans and Democrats to just like be able to sit across the table and actually speak to each other. But when you're in the company of another person, when you're having an actual interaction with another person, even if they're on the other side, it makes it really difficult to think that they're simple. It forces you to complicate your perception of who they are, and sort of allow for variation that you might not have allowed for in the first place. I mean, I always think about this, but when I was an editor at Medium, I commissioned a bunch of interviews with like 18-year-olds all over the country. And I remember, and I grew up in Boston. I live in New York. I've lived in the Northeast pretty much my whole life. I remember we were doing an interview with a kid from Wisconsin, and he was just talking about hunting. He loved to hunt. He hunts with his dad. And so, you know, in my head, I'm kind of putting him in this box. He's a guy that hunts. I don't even need to know the rest of his story. But then as he keeps talking, he says that he has to get home from hunting in time for dance class. And I remember reading the transcript and saying, like, dance class? Like, what's dance class? And it turns out that he's like a ballet dancer as well as a hunter in Wisconsin. And so those sorts of realizations that there's more complexity on the other side than we give them credit for, I think are hugely valuable, because it just kind of throws up a speed bump in the road to extreme polarization and dehumanization. It makes you pause for a second and be like, maybe I don't really know, you know, maybe I don't have a great grasp on what motivates those people. Maybe I don't know them as much as I think I know them. And maybe I should pause for a second and try to contemplate that they are complex, like people on my side are complex.
This is a dated analogy because it would take place obviously before COVID and restrictions on airplanes and so forth. But let's go back to 2019, let's say, and you're on an airplane and I'm flying and I look at other people who are three in a row, and there are so many people that are having conversations with the people next to them. I don't do that. It fascinates me that there are so many people that want to do that. My point is, does this get into a introvert extrovert type thing? Because somebody has to start it, right?
Yeah. My kind of working theory on the introvert extrovert breakdown kind of goes like this. Firstly, a lot of the researchers I talked to for this, and a lot of the activists I talked to or spent time with, who are trying to get people to have conversations with strangers, actually identified as introverts. So they saw the value of having these interactions, but they were also kind of uncomfortable, like, initiating them. So they wanted to create structures that would allow people to have these interactions as introverts, right? Because I think extroverts are really good at initiating conversations, but as we all know, we've all been in, like, hostage situations on a plane or a bus where, like, someone is just, like, impervious to our cues that we don't feel like talking to them.
Yes.
That certainly happens. Don't be one of those people. I am not telling people to be that kind of guy. But extroverts, you know, good at starting, but maybe not so good at listening, maybe not so good at, like, being really attuned to what the people are saying. I find that introverts are better at that part of the conversation. I feel like when they're comfortable, they're better at having the conversation, but they might not be as good at starting it. So I feel like extroverts and introverts actually have a lot to teach each other in this, and ideally resulting in a situation where both can benefit from it. But I was really struck by that. You know, most of the people I talked to were not extroverts who were really into this, who had really felt the sort of benefits of this sort of interaction.
When you think of that dynamic, and you just said something that I thought was interesting, when you talk to people and activists that are looking for conversation. So an activist in this subject is looking for what? What are they hoping to get us to do?
They want people to recognize what we have lost in a lot of cases. I think for previous generations, it was much more normal to talk to strangers than it is for my generation and younger generations for a host of reasons. And we are social animals. We really benefit from having passing interactions with people, having deeper interactions with people. We benefit from making new friends, making new contacts, meeting new romantic partners. All of these things are critical to the spread and success of human species. Now, these activists they have a bunch of different aims. Like, I hung out with people who wanted to deal with political polarization by getting Republicans and Democrats to speak to each other. I met people who wanted to try to deal with the loneliness epidemic. You know, we see that rates of loneliness are skyrocketing, even before COVID, and now they're actually getting worse. It turns out that talking to strangers is a pretty good treatment for loneliness. And some people like the more kind of the wisdom aspect of it, the humanistic aspect of it, the importance of recognizing the experience of other people that might be different from you, and then the power of just feeling that you can communicate with someone you don't know. We bring so much anxiety into these interactions that when we do have one and it goes well, we're so relieved that, number one, it went well. Like, the person didn't attack us, so that's good, despite what we were told by all the police who kept going to my grade school when I was a kid. But there's something hugely reassuring about having those interactions and having them go well, to basically be in the company with a completely random person and realize that we are kind of wired for this as long as we feel comfortable doing it. And once you do that, you can really reap the benefits.
The name of the book is The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. It's published by Random House. Joe Cohane, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. It was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Power of Strangers. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.